All right, well, this is a great crowd. Maybe the largest I've yet had for interest in this book. I have like a bazillion slides here, and I'm not going to go through all of them. I'm going to try and talk for 20 minutes, give you an overview of the book. Usually when I give this talk to my colleagues in anthropology or philosophy or political theory, I have to explain the entire book because I can be relatively sure that none of them are going to read it. But with this audience, I might actually get a few people reading the book. So hopefully I can skip over some of the parts and direct you towards it, and you can enjoy it on your own time. I brought a copy, actually. I can pass it around. You can put your burrito-smeared hands over it, and we'll make it the official Berkman copy if you want to look at it. The book, which has just come out and which has been in the works for about 6 years, I would say, has three parts. Befitting a book which is by an anthropologist, it has a large beginning section which is about hackers, geeks, the history of the internet, and this concept of recursive publics, which shows up throughout the book, which is related to public sphere theory. And so that section is a kind of ethnographic introduction and a theoretical introduction. The largest section of the book is this second section, which is what I think of as an analytic history of free software, in which what I tried to do was divide up the practices of free software into five different core practices that make free software what it is, and try and look in detail at each of those historically, how they emerged, how they came together as practices which make sense to the people who engage in them, and how, when you've got all five of them, you have free software. And then the third part, which hopefully maybe we can take some time to talk about today, is what I'm calling modulations, which is where these practices from free software have been taken up by domains that are not necessarily only software, but modulated into other domains of culture, science, medicine, places where software is obviously relevant because it's relevant just to just about every sphere of life these days, but where the practices themselves have actually been applied in ways that are not directly related to software. Since there are a lot of people here on the Citizen Media Project and interested in journalism, that might be one way to think about where this notion of modulations might have some effective purchase in thinking about free software. The important part for me in writing this book was the subtitle of the book, The Cultural Significance of Free Software, because I don't think there's really a book out there that that actually tries to articulate what it is that makes free software distinctive and why it's important. In particular, why there are so many people who react to it almost intuitively, right? Once they know a certain amount of things about free software, it seems to make sense in a way that other kinds of practices related to free software might not. And one of the ways in which I tried to articulate what that significance is by talking about how it encourages modification, how people think about taking free software, modifying it, creating something new, and in fact, actually not just modifying the software itself, but modifying the practices that go into making that free software and taking it into new domains. And one of the things that allows people to do, in particular in free software, if anybody's wondering, I learned this technique from Larry Lessig, if anybody's seen any of I'm just not using the black screen with the white text, I'm using the white screen with the black text, but I'll stop doing it in a moment. The cultural significance of free software, as far as I'm concerned, is that it makes things public. And that phrase actually has a lot of things embedded in it. One is that I'm interested in the way in which software is a kind of material object that people work with. It's something which actually is halfway between material and ideal, right? It's something that you can work with in the same way that mathematicians work with ideas, but it's also something very tangible and practical, and it's something that people who work in software develop techniques and tools for managing in the same way that craftspeople in all kinds of domains work with. And the fact that it makes that free software makes things public is important to me because what it's doing is actually rendering the software that's created public in a relatively radical way, as far as I characterize it, which is to say it's not just making the software publicly or freely available for people, it's doing so in a manner in which it ensures the possibility of it continuing to be public. If people take it up and use it and reuse it, especially under the terms of licenses like the GPL, it makes it permanently public so long as people continue to use it, employ it, distribute it, things like that. I asked the question usually when I start this talk about what would it mean to do an anthropology of free software, and one of the places I started was asking, why do geeks look alike? and these are actually kind of geeks. This is Ken Thompson and Dennis Ritchie, the inventors of the Unix operating system. And I think it's kind of like people, you know, say that their people and their dogs start to look alike. I think these two started to look alike the more they worked on this project together. But they're, you know, they're sort of the heroes of the book in some way, because they're at the origins of the Unix operating system and at many of the aspects of the culture which I track in the Unix philosophy that lead to free software in the 1990s. But where I started in anthropology was actually asking, what is it that makes geeks hang together, right? Why is it that, you know, people who sort of consider themselves geeks in some very loose sense — this is not a once and for all definition, but just people who have interests in common — can find each other across pretty broad range of characteristics, nations, languages, professions, histories, etc. And I actually did a lot of field work in terms of trying to answer this question, and traveled all over the world. I started here, and in fact, my principal informants are here at the table, the men from Med Commons here, who very generously started me off on this project 10 years ago now. So it's actually quite an honor to have them here at this point with the book out and everything. But Sean and Adrian were there, starting a project called Amicus and later one called Med Commons, both of which drew in different ways from what they knew about free software and ways in which they tried to combine free software with questions about business plans and profitability in the healthcare industry. From there, I went to Berlin. I worked for a while with a group called Micro, which organized kind of a Berkman Center thing, but mostly media activists and artists organized around things related to the internet and free software. I went to India, where I worked with the Bangalore Linux Users Group, met Uday, who's labeled here, Uday, who has a group of people around him called Friends of Uday, who he refers to himself sometimes as this random networker, and it's true. He's got this amazing network of people that he knows. He's often introducing me to people that I already know, but it means more when Uday introduces me to them, right? It's like I've made it into some important network by virtue of that. This is where I lived, Silicon Valley. That's what it was called in Bangalore. And that man was fixing my phone. I was hoping that he was fixing my internet, but he wasn't. When I went to Houston, to Rice University, I hooked up with roughly around the same time the people who were organizing Creative Commons in 2002, and a group at Rice called the Connections Project, which is one of the first cases I looked at in terms of what I'm calling modulations, where what they were interested in doing was taking the practices of free software and applying them to scholarly textbooks. And so they did that, and what they did was sort of try and modularize the textbook, create a repository that anyone could put these modules into, and then provide them freely using free software licenses. So I asked certain questions about why I thought geeks recognized each other across all of these domains. And it was true that, you know, I could go from Boston, where I could have a conversation with Sean and Adrian about free software, to Berlin, where I could have a conversation about free software in stilted German, but still talk about copyright and configuring my Linux server and all of these things, to India, where I could have the same conversation again, but this time in English again. And, you know, it was easy to do this, to go around the world and have this kind of conversation. So whatever constituted the affinity of people, it wasn't necessarily the things that we classically think of in anthropology as markers of affinity: nationality, ethnicity, race, language, schooling, etc. It was something else. And I ultimately came to define that in terms of their ability to participate in the internet to begin with, right? The notion of the recursive public is meant to signal that the thing that draws them together is the thing they're building in common, namely the internet. And so this did not include, for instance, geeks who were not necessarily on the internet or who were not schooled in the ways of the internet, but it did include anybody who had discovered the internet and, by virtue of doing that, discovered various things that allowed them to understand how the internet worked. And free software is probably one of the single most important domains that allows people to understand those things about the internet. The second part of the book, and I'll go through this pretty quickly here just so that we don't get too tired here, is this breaking up a free software into five components. And the reason I wanted to do this was that I started out in a sort of classic scholarly way of asking, what is it that makes free software free software? And if anybody here has participated in free software, you know that one of the most frustrating parts is the sort of endless attempt to define what free software is, right? And it just goes on and on and on, and you can have this conversation forever. And so what I did was try and take a step back and locate sort of five domains of discussion that people had about what made free software, right? And rather than come up with a definition, these domains characterize things that people who engage in free software have to do in order to engage in free software. And those things include being part of a movement, namely proselytizing for free software, right? You can't really be part of free software unless you're out there evangelizing, right? Sharing source code. You have to be able to share source code. Thinking about the definition of openness and what openness means, and in particular how openness is related to the infrastructures that you use. Writing copyleft licenses. You absolutely need copyleft licenses to be doing free software. And coordinating collaboration in some form, technically and socially. So these were sort of the five domains that I identified. And then the center part of this book is an attempt to think historically about how those things coalesced into free software. So the way you can think about this is that in 1998, free software emerged in the public imaginary as something extremely new and exciting and whatnot. It had been going on for 20 years for some people underground in a subterranean fashion, but it was in 1998 that really a lot of people started to pay attention, kind of coincident with the founding of the Berkman Center, in fact, right? And interest at the Harvard Law School in issues related to this. All kinds of things happened at the same time. One of my markers for this is the appearance of Forbes magazine in 1998 with this great big picture of Linus Torvalds. And on the inside are Richard Stallman and Brian Behlendorf and Larry Wall and all of the other sort of figures that we associate with free software. And all of these practices sort of came together at this point. And one of the other things that happened at that point that was so important was that people started to differentiate between the terms free software and open source, right? So prior to 1998, you really only referred to it as free software, or you used an array of other labels like open sourceware or sourceware or freeware or share. And there was a lot of sort of confusion about what the right label was. But 1998 really saw this emergence of a real sort of ideological split between those people who referred to what they were doing as open source and those people who referred to what they were doing as free software. And much of this discussion that happened in the movement's sort of birth in 1998 was about these tensions. And the interesting thing about the split between free and open source software is that regardless of which side you come down on ideologically, whether you insist that you're open source or insist that you're free software, the other four practices that I list there, they're exactly the same, right? So people are doing exactly the same thing, regardless of whether or not they say what they're doing is open source or free software. So in some ways, it's about the arguments they give to make sense of the practices which they're all sharing at some level. And the way you can see this is that it's pretty easy to see when people get included in or excluded from free software or open source, right? It's easy to be excluded from being open or free software, i.e. if you're Microsoft. Your shared source program at Microsoft does not count as open source or free software as far as free software geeks are concerned, right? So you can see pretty easily how people draw these lines. And they're fuzzy at the edges, obviously. They're always border cases, but they're pretty clear lines for what participates. So the other four practices then, as I say, I'll go through fairly quickly. Sharing source code. This is primarily about the history of the Unix operating system and the way in which the Unix operating system really provided the sort of framework from which people were able to think about sharing source code. It seems like an obvious thing to be able to share source code, but it actually took a fair amount of work to think about how to do so. And Unix was an interesting kind of monstrous example of an operating system because it was neither commercial nor academic, right? It was at Bell Labs. It had a kind of commercial side to it in that AT&T licensed it and circulated it, but it was basically a research project that Ken and Dennis were working on. And one of the reasons that it had this odd status, and even though it was circulating in the 1970s, was that it was restricted by monopoly law from being commercialized as an operating system. So AT&T was not allowed to actually commercialize the operating system until 1984 when AT&T was divested. And so there was this tension with Unix. It couldn't be properly commercialized as a product in the 1970s, and yet Ken and Dennis were creating it, circulating it all over the world, taking people's updates and reincorporating them into each new version, et cetera, and essentially forging this culture of collaboratively producing a fairly complex software project kind of under the radar of the lawyers and the product managers at AT&T, who couldn't really control it because they weren't allowed to commercialize it. So they weren't focusing their attention there. And I tell a couple of good stories here. People know about John Lyons, for instance, and his commentary on the 6th edition of Unix Source Code, which is a great little book called The Most Photocopied Document in the History of Computer Science, which was essentially a kind of literary criticism of the operating system. He did line-by-line commentary on it, and it circulated extremely widely. It ended up being something which was used in computer science classrooms all over the world, and AT&T tried to restrict it. And it really was one of those things that helped produce a culture around Unix. Unix led to Minix, and the story of how Minix led to Linux is often retold. There's a kind of direct lineage here in terms of rewriting the operating system in order to make it more freely available, both in the case of what Andrew Tannenbaum did with Minix and then with what Linus Torvalds did with Linux. Defining an open infrastructure is a section of the book that focuses on the open systems debates in the 1980s, and in particular on the ways in which the standards for both Unix as potentially a networked operating system that would be widely used and TCP/IP turned out to be failures in different ways, right? The failure in the case of Unix was that there was a tremendous amount of energy put into standardizing Unix and it didn't work. The eventual outcome, sorry, people have seen Eric Levinet's chart. This is a chart of the proliferation of Unix, right? It got to the point where it was so incompatible with itself that there was no hope of standardizing it. And the sort of outcome of that that story is that Microsoft NT had a huge opening there, which it took full advantage of in the 1990s. The other story, the story of TCP/IP, is interesting because in the 1980s, an alternate model for networking, the open systems interconnection model, was in fact already standardized. It had reached consensus in Geneva, which is an extremely difficult thing to do. And everyone agreed that it was going to be the standard, and everyone was ready to, you know, go down this horrible path that no one wanted to go down because it was so complex and complete. And something happened, which is that TCP/IP really started to take off right around this period, in part because it was freely available in the Unix operating system. People could look at it, learn from it, re-implement it, and it was a sort of lightweight, more lightweight implementation than what it would have been required of OSI, and in part because of the World Wide Web, right? By the time the World Wide Web took off in 1993, everybody was installing TCP/IP on their computer, even on their operating system, even if they were, you know, committed to OSI. So it's an interesting story of the failure of this international legitimate consensus around a standard and the appearance of a de facto standard. And then, of course, copyright licenses. And the story that I tell in the book is actually fairly narrowly focused on the origin of the GPL, which is a really interesting story that happens when Richard Stallman decides to rewrite Emacs for Unix, because the person that had been taking care of Emacs for Unix, James Gosling, had sold it to a commercial company, and this made Richard Stallman, as you might imagine, extremely angry. He rewrote it. He borrowed part of what James Gosling had done, and it produced this incredible controversy on Usenet about whether or not what he had done was illegal, even though Stallman is often credited with the creation of Emacs to begin with, right? So he was sort of accused of violating the copyright on something which he had invented. And this led him in some ways to formalize what he'd been trying to do before. He'd been calling it the Emacs Commune, and everyone had to sort of contribute their bits and pieces back to this commune, but it had no legal teeth. By 1985, he'd figured out a way to give it a legal form in the form of a license. And that's the license that we all live with today in free software worlds. All of the licenses are based on that in some way or another. There are lots of variations. You can write your own license, and people often do, but they often achieve the same kind of thing in free software. Yeah.
So there are many different kinds of licenses. I mean,
yes.
There's the GPL, but there's also free clause BSD licenses.
license, right. the MIT license, the X license.
Now there's the Creative Commons license.
I mean, can you trace their lineage to a common source?
Yeah, you can. Not all of them come directly from the GPL. The MIT license is the other source, and that was for X Windows, which emerged at the same time. But since it, and I haven't actually done this work, but since it was at MIT, and so was the Free Software Foundation, it's quite likely that some of the same people were involved in writing both of those. So you can trace the origins of these licenses to the period between 1985 and 1989, and they all emerged there. The only one I've been able to find which comes from elsewhere is Guido von Rossum's Python had a kind of informal, not quite legal license attached to it when he circulated it in the 1980s. But I haven't been able to find any other examples of this. And then the final component is the notion of how people coordinate collaboration on software. And this is the story of the two canonical cases of free software, the Apache web server and the Linux operating system, and the different ways in which the governance of the creation of free and open source software is managed. So Linux is often held up as an example of benevolent dictatorship, right? Linux has complete control over what goes into the kernel, or did at a certain point. And Apache, a more meritocratic system of voting people into a kind of oligarchy, each of which has some power to decide what goes into the project, et cetera. So it's a way of showing that in the free software world, there are lots of different governance models as well, lots of different ways of doing free software, and that it's not just one model of free software. And it's certainly not, as Steven Weber also pointed out, self-organizing in any sort of, like, things just come together and happen sense. The other part of this is the story of source code management tools, which are extremely important for managing both people and technology at the same time, because they manage what people can do with software, and they manage who can do what to software. So they sort of manage people and technology together at the same time, integrated into a whole for people who are using source code management tools. So those are the sort of five elements that I claim make free software work. And the third part, as I suggested, is this section on modulations. And what I do in that section is essentially try to show how, if you look at each of these five domains of practices in the case of some new project, you can see how these modulations are happening in each of those practices. So the case of connections, this project at Rice University that I mentioned, where you take university textbooks and divide them up into modular chunks, put them into a repository, and allow anyone to freely recombine or reuse them, kind of tries to modulate each of these practices, right? So instead of source code, in the classic sense of what source code means for software, they substitute textbook modules, right? These are the things that are being shared, rewritten, reused, et cetera. In terms of open infrastructure, they also rely on the internet, obviously, but XML is the language in which all of this is written, and it's a standard which they rely on to be suitably standardized and successful that their project will succeed in the future. They substituted the Creative Commons licenses for the GPL, and in fact, that was something that I participated in very carefully with them, because it was at the same time that the Creative Commons people were trying to figure out what should these licenses look like, and what difference would it make for scholarly materials in particular that were not software, right? What kinds of conditions on them? The question of coordination is the one they haven't answered, and that's a really interesting one, right? Because in academia, this might not be obvious to this crowd, but in academia, people don't write textbooks together. They write them alone, because there's such an incredible power in having that prestige attached to your name. You are the author of the textbook on calculus. Occasionally, there are two or three people who write a textbook together. Some of the big biology textbooks have five or six people on them, but basically, one person writes textbooks. And so how would you even imagine coordinating a whole bunch of academics together to produce quality material? And that's something which I am constantly ribbing them about, because I don't think they've figured it out, and I don't think the project will be completely successful until they do. But it's been useful for them to think about it in the terms that I'm presenting here, right? Because they've solved, you know, four or five problems, but the fifth one is a really tricky one for them. And then the question of evangelizing or proselytizing for open textbooks is also taken off in the form of an open educational resources declaration for people who create and use educational resources. Another case that I've looked at that I think is actually really interesting is the case of biology, where there are a number of different projects that some of you may or may have heard of, especially around here. One of them is the project over at MIT to in synthetic biology to create a registry of standard biological parts that can be combined and recombined to create new biologically engineered tools, essentially. And there, they draw on directly on the heritage of free and open source software as inspiration for their project, as well as modulating the practices that are involved. There are a couple of others, just since I put them up here. There's this group, this project called BIOS, which is largely just a man named Richard Jefferson, who's worked really hard to try and figure out ways to make biotechnology in terms of agriculture especially come into line more with the practices of free and open source software. And then something which I kind of briefly participated in at Rice, which was a project on open source nanotechnology, which I'd be happy to talk about because it involves making nanotechnology in your kitchen. So it's a lot of fun. But here, the same project, the same kind of focus on thinking about modulation in terms of these practices is operative. The source code, the question of source code is not just publications and data, but it's also, in fact, gene sequences and genomes, cell parts and enzymatic pathways, model organisms, cell cultures. There's a lot of material things which actually circulate in biology, and the question is, do those things circulate with or without legal constraints? If they circulate with legal constraints, what do those legal constraints look like, right? Do they look like free and open source software licenses or not? An open infrastructure, the question of infrastructure is actually very interesting here because it has to do with how laboratory protocols work, how pedagogy works, people train to work in a laboratory, for instance, whether or not people use the same nomenclature. My experience with the chemists in nanotechnology was that despite the fact that they were all talking about working on buckyballs, none of them could agree what a buckyball was. And these were nanotechnologists, right? This wasn't just like a question of whether or not we were going to call it a buckyball or not. Like, they really literally didn't know if in one lab to the next lab they were working on the same objects. And so that kind of standardization is actually quite difficult. The license question obviously is extremely important because it's about not just copyright in the domain of biology, but patents, right? And it's incredibly more difficult in this domain because there are so many more patents, right? And so many more effective patents. And getting patents is so much more expensive than putting a copyright on something, right? So a lot of the dynamics of thinking about things the way that you might with the GPL or the copyright license is much different in terms of patents. And then, of course, the question of coordination across biological labs, for instance, comes up. And one of the ways in which the people at MIT with their synthetic biology project have tried to achieve this is through competitions, right? Essentially saying to lots and lots of undergraduates, try and engineer something really creative and cool. You can be part of this competition. You might win. The only requirement is that you put your parts into our open source repository, right? And so that's a way of creating an incentive for more people to contribute to this because they've actually had, kind of like the Connections Project, a lot of trouble figuring out how to convince academics to contribute to these things. Turns out in free software and open source software, contribution is much more likely outside of academia than it is inside, which is not ironic if you think about it because the dynamics of credit and ownership in academia are much, much more intense in some ways than they are outside of that. So that's, and then of course, in terms of the movement, there's not much of a movement around something like synthetic biology. In fact, there's more concern than there is movement, especially around things like biosecurity, biohazard, the potential release of these materials. But there is, in terms of open access, quite a movement around the making open data and publications open access in order to improve the process of science. So, I think I'll actually stop here because the rest of what I might have to say I can probably get to in questions if people raise questions. But I would pose here just this sort of or open this question of whether or not people have other examples that they might want to think of in terms of modulation, because I really do think that the practices that free software has pioneered over the last 25 years, even if people don't recognize what they're doing as free software or as related to free and open source software, are there in the background. And one of the reasons that I think that's true is because they were such an important part of the growth and spread of the internet itself. And so to the extent that people are thinking about the internet as a model or a platform, an environment within which they work, there are aspects of free software that are there in the background, whether or not they recognize it. have, please, questions, discussion.
Yeah, that was actually, yeah. You just hit on what I was going to ask about is, do you think we've reached that point where these free, open, distributed approaches have become a sort of general part of the cultural toolkit such that people are pulling it out and using it, in fact, sometimes completely unaware of its lineage?
Yes, I do. And in fact, this gets back to why the book is called The Cultural Significance of Free Software, because in some ways you can find these practices anywhere, right? There are lots of places where they show up, not just the licenses, but collaborate. I mean, Web 2.0 in some ways is all about taking advantage of that component that I called collaboration or coordinating collaborations, right? Whether or not that's classic hierarchical coordination or coordination in the form of social bookmarking or something like that, right? So you see those practices there. But the reason I had five of them and the reason I said they were necessary is because I think free software is interesting not just because it's free software, but because it makes things public. And it makes things public in a sense that they are rendered permanently so, or at least permanently so long as people continue to use and attempt to make it public, right? It's a way of making free software available to the next generation, as it were, right? And if you take one of those practices away, you don't necessarily keep that aspect of free software. And that's one of the reasons why people say, oh, well, that's not free software anymore, right? Even though I don't think a lot of people can articulate that making public of free software is the important part, in fact, that's what they mean when they say that's not free software. That's my suggestion here.
Expand on that and this whole idea of modulation. I wonder if you consider art and the art world and a lot of things that have been going on with, I mean, to go back to MIT, they've recently been involved in the development of the processing language, which has been really used by a lot of the digital art community.
Yep.
And one option that you have with that is to publish, of course, the source code. That's the default. So you kind of always have the option to improve upon and to tinker with existing digital art projects. But at the same time, I wonder if this would actually potentially come out of a different heritage, because the art world has its own lineage of appropriation and cultures of collage.
Right.
And how do you think, is that tied into this free software movement, or is it, you know, more autonomous as a lineage?
I think it's actually more autonomous in some ways, because there's different ways to answer this question. One is sociologically, are there interesting overlaps between communities of people who participated in collage and cut up and remix and whatnot and free software? And I think the answer to that is definitely yes, right? If you look, Brian Behlendorf is a good example, actually, right? He has connections to lots of different communities which bring many of these different traditions together. But in terms of what collage or remix or mashup or any of those things attempt to achieve, it may not necessarily be the same kind of lineage as free software. And one of the reasons that's different is because I don't think everything needs to be made public. Free software is public because it's infrastructural, right? It's something, it's a tool which everyone uses. And so the kind of force behind making free software public is to say, as Richard Stallman does, these tools are what we use to create. They should be freely available. And, you know, he pushes that so far as to suggest they're essentially part of us, right? That you know, if you make them private, you're privatizing yourself, right? The history of art is always in somewhat more tension with that, right? Especially insofar as the market is involved here, right? And if the kind of art you're doing is something where you expect to get a living from it, then the dynamics of whether or not you make something public are going to be much different. And that is even clearer in the case of music, right? And the discussions with Creative Commons around whether or not to do, for instance, a sampling license or a non-commercial license, et cetera, always come down to this issue. Like, are people going to be able to make a living from what they create? And the free software movement has never really sought to make a living from what it creates. It's sought to make a living from creating really great tools, which then transfer or somehow allow them to make money in some other way, right? Because they have skills and tools that allow them to do things which they can make money on a service model or on some other by getting hired by a corporation, essentially.
That's kind of, I think, that's a little historical in the sense that if you look at the original sort of New Manifesto itself, it actually says, well, you know, maybe programmers don't need to make money. You know, there are lots of other things that you can do, and maybe people can write in their script.
Right.
So in fact, it actually started out with this idea of not saying that programmers won't make money, but saying we don't know.
Yeah, we don't know.
We think that it's actually. So a more maybe optimistic way of approaching that same statement is to say, we've decided that we as free software developers or
advocates have decided that access to software or control over technology by its users is so important that we think that it needs to happen, period. Now, we don't know how to make that happen in ways that we get to work on it, but maybe if we feel that it's so, but we believe that software is so important and that people respect it, that we'll find ways as creative sort of people to make money out of doing it. And you could say the same thing, I think, about other types of
And this is actually one of the places where I think there's a lot of criticism and questioning about free and open source software, because, you know, obviously people who are in that position have a certain amount of privilege to be able to do that. And that's, it's not clear to me exactly how to think about this, right? Because it's not, it doesn't make it wrong that they have the privilege to do that, right? But it also doesn't make it natural, right? It's not something that, you know, just anybody can sit down and do this, right? People who have to be in a certain position where they can afford to spend their evenings, right, working on free software and working from 9 to 5, or have made enough money that they don't have to work from 9 to 5 but can spend their time working on these projects, right? Or simply have the passion to do it and are willing to live in that sort of classic artistic mold of the starving artist, right, who works on free software, which is also a possibility. So it's not clear how to think about that, but I think it's a line of questioning which is still open here about that.
But like the main public of the architecture, the software itself. The other thing that we're seeing, especially with the modules you're talking about in terms of biology, is the opening up of data.
Uh-huh.
And the way that we've segmented actually the relationship between data and analysis and architecture in for all intents and purposes, modules.
Uh-huh.
And you know, you make this comment also about, you know, academe and
uh-huh.
the ongoing problems with academe. And I wonder how some of this, I mean, like, for example, 23andMe on the screen
uh-huh.
comes from grad students who were pissed off that they couldn't get the data they wanted,
right.
So they figured out ways of encouraging people to make data. So I'm curious how you see these bits relating to one another and reshaping not just free software and the software movement, but other relationships between architecture, data, and analysis.
Well, you know, I think that... you know, by breaking it up into practices like this, you can see places where the influence is obviously there. It may not result in the same kind of dynamics that made people sit up and pay attention to free software and open source software, right? However, you can certainly track the influence of that. And in terms of things like data and tools in science, again, the BioBricks Registry of Standard Biological Parts is actually a really good case here, because the two principal people in that, Drew Endy and Jay Kiesling, are committed to the idea of open source biological hacking, essentially, but they are also heavily invested in corporations that they run, right, and which have patents on all of the machines that they use and the processes that they're creating, right? So they're playing both horses, as it were. And their commitment is not of the same sort that I think it was for a lot of free software hackers, where there was really a sense that if you box this stuff up, if you make it proprietary and there's no option for people to improve it or change it or whatnot, then you'll make no progress at all, right? For the biologists at this point, I think there's still this question, like, is that true? Is it in fact the case that if we go down a route that's entirely commercialized biology, we will no longer be able to make the kinds of innovations that we have in the past? And so the question is still in some ways open in that field. And certainly, I think a lot of people, as you mentioned, like with 23andMe, a lot of people are recognizing that when they want to do something, access to data, access to tools, access to infrastructures is incredibly expensive or legally very difficult to get to. And that people experience immediately as a barrier to innovation, right? A sense like, oh, I have this great idea, but I can't make it happen, for reasons that have nothing to do with my enthusiasm or energy or even my money, right? You know, so. Yes, my anthropology.
You couldn't have set my question up better. We're working on fair use for educators,
uh-huh.
and one of the big sticking points there is teachers who create curriculum but want to share it
uh-huh.
and are prevented from doing so by what they perceive as either institutional pressures
right.
or exterior legal pressures, or usually some combination of the two.
Right. Right.
What I wanted to ask you was, you're talking about the problems in academia, and it seemed like what you were mentioning were reputational concerns,
uh-huh. yeah.
and I wondered how much of that is really what's motivating people from being insecure about sharing, or whether it's universities saying, no, or threat of lawsuits, or what?
Well, there's a bit of both. The aspect that I was referring to of credit and reputation has primarily to do with the issue of whether or not people contribute to something like a free software project, right? The sense that if I set up this really great project in chemistry to free all of the world's knowledge about chemistry and all of the protocols and whatnot, how do I convince all my chemistry colleagues to contribute to that, right? And in academia, the kind of standard mode of working is that if I do that, I have to get a publication out of it, or I have to get my name on something, or I get a prize for it or something, because I'm not going to be paid. I'm not going to be paid in any case, right? That's one of the sort of trade-offs you make in academia. But you know, I'm not just going to give it away, because that's unproductive labor, as it were, right? So you have to get some sort of credit for that. And that's really, there's actually lessons to be learned from free software in that sense, too, because free software is extraordinarily good when it works at distributing credit widely to everyone who contributes, even at the lowest level. People who find bugs, right, and just send in a bug report often get credited in a good free software project, right? So distributing that kind of credit is extremely important. And in academia, there are already mechanisms for doing that. So that's a big part of it. But I think when you look at the really commercialized realms of science in academia, like biology these days, you find a lot of more turbulent dynamics that have to do with the presence of lots and lots of money as well, especially if it's anywhere near pharmaceuticals or energy right now. So,
furthering out about the question of money and perhaps reluctance to do this, and, you know, my understanding is that, you know, aside from whatever prestige you get from writing textbooks, writing a really successful textbook can also be very lucrative.
Yeah.
And how does that factor into possible reluctance for people to enter collaborative mode for writing?
I feel like our cooperation group or something has done something on this, right?
Like that people always overestimate the amount of money they're going to get from their textbook, right? It's like that process of going in to write a textbook is like, well, it's going to make me fabulously wealthy, when 99% of the people are paid, you know, they get some royalties.
Which is what provides
the incentive for everyone else to think they're going to be that blockbuster, right? And so I do think that that's an important part. And that's, if you look at, for instance, the statistics that Creative Commons keeps about the kinds of licenses that people choose, the non-commercial license is very high up there on certain kinds of content. And it's precisely because I think this people have this sense that however vanishingly small it is, there is a chance that my mashup of Britney Spears and whatever else is going to become fabulously successful, and I'll be able to retire on it, right? And that the decision to choose non-commercial at that point is so easy that even though is low,
well,
often.
I think in your example of the mashup, there's another reason in that people feel, whether rightly or wrongly, that if they put a non-commercial license to their music, they're a bit less likely to get hit by a big lawsuit.
That was a bad example. You're right. People might be thinking about that as well. But if it's something that they've created, a curriculum or something, or a textbook, I think there is that sense.
So early on in introducing your talk, you used the intriguing phrase recursive publics.
Yes.
And I assume by that you mean publics that are simultaneously creating the tools and the space in which they're able to interact as well as interacting. So I wanted to ask you, first of all, to play that out a little bit. I also wanted to ask you, to what extent free software is sort of a unique moment in history around that, whether you see parallels going further back to university cultures in Germany in the 1800s, of the other parallels that people toss out around now.
So, there's a long story which involves looking at Habermas's and other versions of the public sphere sort of thinking about what it is that people have designated as the definition of a public sphere, a properly functioning public sphere. And one of the interesting things about public sphere literature in academia is that there's pretty much unanimous agreement that it no longer exists, right? That we don't have public spheres anymore. Habermas's idealized version of it that emerged in the 18th century was something that had basically these characteristics. It was a voluntary association amongst people. It was a place for rational and critical debate about issues. It was independent of power, independent of the church, of the state, of corporations, of whoever. And it forced those governing entities to be accountable to the opinion of that public, right? So that's the sort of idealized version of it. Now, one of the things that I wanted to do in thinking about a recursive public was to suggest that a couple of different things are going on here. One is that we're actually making things and circulating things which are not just discourse, right? We're not, it's not just ideas about the way the world should be or political beliefs about whether or not we should or shouldn't go to war, et cetera, et cetera. We're creating things in free software that are circulating very widely. I create Emacs and it circulates very widely and it allows people to do other things like write their ideas about whether or not we should go to war, right? Or write more free software, right? So there's a sense in which technology is part of what we make public, but we don't often talk about that in political theory, right? In political theory, we restrict ourselves to talking about discourse for the most part. And the other way in which I think about this is that if you think about the way that the internet works, and this is where in part the recursive label comes from, right, is that in order for free software to be free or for the internet to be free as far as geeks are concerned, each of the layers beneath that have to be free to some extent, right? And that can go down to even to the level of the public infrastructure in the sense of it being public and not being owned by private corporations but being owned by a government or by the people, right? So depending on the level to which you push that, there's a kind of recursivity, right? You're constantly pushing down the definition of what counts as free at one level until you've solved the problem of what counts as free at the level beneath that, and the level beneath that, and the level beneath that. And once you can be assured that you've got freedom at this low level, then you can come back up and say, okay, well, now we can ensure freedom at this level, right? And so I think people are very familiar with that idea because of the way in which the protocols and the standards and the software of the internet are all freely available and open. People can look at them, you can shine the bright light on them and say, do these work correctly? You can propose an alternative. You can say, this TCP/IP thing, it's just not working. Here's an alternative, right? Nobody has to adopt it, right? But people might, and you can propose it, and you can base it on that one that already exists, right? Which is much different than when things are closed up in secret so that no one can see them, or proprietary in the sense that you can't actually change it, even if you can see it. Right, so that's part of what the recursive public's idea is meant to capture. And I think that in the case of free software, it does produce a kind of authentic public sphere in that Habermasian sense because it allows people to be certain to a very large extent that what they've created is going to stay public. Right? It would take a lot of effort to make unpublic the things that free software has created. And that is one of the barriers for a lot of people who contribute, right? Is that, you know, if I can't be certain that when I put all of this energy into making something public, if some corporation can come along and box it up and sell it, then maybe I'm not so confident in making it freely available. Some people don't care about that, but I would say someone like... Well, but it depends on what the public it's counter to is.
Terms, uh-huh. Right? Like, which is the constant relation of publics and counterpublics, you know, constantly in conversation with one another. And in some ways, especially given the resistant nature of so much of geek culture, it is constantly countering a certain kind, yes, of hegemonic narrative.
Yes, insofar as there's a sense that, you know, free software is an alternative to something which everybody agrees is a good idea, namely proprietary software or, you know, not making things public, making things private, it is a counterculture, a counterpublic to that.
Not necessarily be meaning in, yeah, collective agreement.
No, certainly not.
It means power.
Yeah. And I think when it's opposed to that, it's definitely a counterpublic in that sense as well. But they're not mutually exclusive, right? The recursive part is meant to capture something else. The technical aspect of it and this layering aspect of it that is fairly specific actually to the internet and not necessarily to any kind of public. So
there's this kind of funny, maybe ironic, truth to what you're saying is in a sense we have all of these independent institutions emerging, the free software movement, the internet, sort of new technologies that, in a sense, aren't necessarily the old,
right,
academic institutions. And there's sort of the things we're calling public. And then in common everyday speak, when we talk about public or public institutions, we usually mean things like government or schools, academia. And in a sense, we're calling those very private, very entrenched. So I had a question about those, because that's where I spend a lot of my time, mm-hmm, sort of the e-government type, mm-hmm, movements, as well as mm-hmm, free educational resources. Do you think that that a sort of speaking directly to the ideas of freedom and sharing and sort of how to design for participation and sharing is as important as getting people to start doing it and appreciating it in small ways and then recursively building off of that mm-hmm. as it makes change? Because right now we're in this difficult place, which is there's not a lot of people who get these ideas well,
mm-hmm.
and even fewer of them who care to spend their time trying to deal with the government at the point where they're listening to like legislative aides
mm-hmm.
and you know really getting down to DC or at their
right.
state level.
Right.
And same with schools. There's a lot of software people, you know, as you pointed out, connections.
Right.
Like what they're not doing is they're
right.
not actually building those
right.
communities.
Right.
They're just providing this third party tool.
Right.
What do you see based upon looking at these successes of actually addressing these institutions? Large entrenched institutions
mm-hmm.
that don't want to share and don't want to collaborate.
Right. So I think, I mean, this is a good and very troubling aspect of what's happened. And in some ways, one answer to the question is that these projects have to emerge from the bottom up, right? They have to happen as something where people who are involved in them do get benefit from them and contribute to them for reasons which are internal to the community of people who are contributed to them, and not because a government says, we will provide this for you as long as you do all of the work, or we will provide this for you as long as, you know, and it will be free, but you have to contribute to it, right? There has to be some understanding of why that's valuable to particular communities of people. And free software, that's an easy case to see, because people are getting so much high-quality software for so little contribution that there's an obvious way in which seeing your participation in that makes sense, right? I will participate because I get so much back from this. That might not be the case in e-government or in textbooks, right? In the sense that there's not a clear understanding of what people get back, and that for me is part of that problem of collaboration and cooperation, right? It's the how you design systems that allow people to participate in these things and get something back. The freedom or the public part of it is actually related to the other practices, right? There are a lot of things out there. Facebook is a good example, where there are tons of people doing things all day long, contributing things, making things on Facebook, but it's not public in that sense, right? It's owned by Facebook, and if something legally untoward happens, it's Facebook's decision to take it down or remove it or whatnot. So they've successfully achieved the collaboration and cooperation component, but have left behind the legal component, right? So that's a sort of long way of saying that I think it really is very domain specific, and it really does depend on what people are trying to achieve. The question of whether or not the, you know, large public institutions or entrenched institutions can be made to change is one that I'm very personally involved with in, for instance, anthropology, right? Because we have this 100-year-old anthropology association, which is our professional society. They publish basically everything that it contains all of our research, right? And they've been incredibly resistant to open access. So it's been very difficult to convince them to make our research freely available. And that is because, in some ways, they're one of these old institutions, and they're there for stability and reliability, and they get a tremendous amount of revenue from those publications. And so convincing them to change is something where just talking about all the good things that it brings is not enough, right? You really have to come up with some alternative model of sustainability for that.
So if you can't, is then the answer revolution?
It might be, and in fact, that's funny that you say that, because that is sort of, you know, that's the debate that I have with several of my colleagues who are involved in this. Like, why do we need a scholarly society, essentially, right? Like, let them go. See ya. And I'm not sure that's the answer, because they do actually provide a lot of things, and if they disappeared, people would notice. Right? So.
Oh, because there's a difference in the work product in free software and the work product in academia.
Yeah.
In academia, you can't just throw a paper out there and expect people to read it. Some people will, but will white people read it? Will your tenure committee read it?
Right. No,
probably, especially not your tenure committee.
You can't have it read officially.
You can't guarantee that for publishing it in the right venue.
Right. Yeah. And you and with free software, you throw a piece of software out there, and it works or it doesn't. Right. There's a very direct meritocratic function that it serves or it doesn't, and that's that's a real
too.
It's a problem in that.
So
you can't translate, you can't make an exact translation from free software to academic discourse.
And I mean, that's part of why I think about these practices in terms of modulations, right? Yeah. Is that people are trying out different versions of this. They're also trying out those different versions in free software, right? So in fact, it does matter if, for instance, you work at IBM, where you put your code, right? Even if it's freely available, right? Some of that is your private stuff that you do at home and you put up because it's your project that you're working on. Some of it is code you write for IBM, which IBM makes freely available, right? So different kinds of corporations are experimenting with modulations of these practices as well. And in certain domains of academia, you can just throw your paper up there, right? In high-energy physics, if you use archive, you can try. You can throw it out there and see if anyone reads it. But you can't do that in anthropology. You can't do that in legal journals are sort of a step away from that, but but they still require a lot of work. Yeah. Sean?
If I was thinking about your five categories and thinking, a different way to look at this was, in an evolutionary sense, right? Yeah. If you didn't have these five characteristics, you were going to get destroyed, right? This is what it needed for an organism to exist like this, right? And the value of this as a model is it provides other, institutions a way of an alternative success story to the one that right now is the corporate closed model. But then, I guess the revolution comment set me off a little bit. I'm just trying to think, how that could work. So, with this one, it seems like what you really want is, for your system, the anthropology side, some sort of horizontal gene transfer, right? Can they inject some of this in there? Or will there be an alternative society that grows up next to it and they get replaced?
Right. I think that's the right way to think about it. I mean, when I was writing this, I was thinking about it more in sort of thermodynamic terms, right? But there's a relation there, right? Like that each of these practices has thresholds, and when you move outside of them, then you're no longer part of that that practice. But yeah, thinking about it evolutionarily is actually also another way to imagine how this model might function, because it is kind of lateral gene transfer that's going on here when people adopt these practices and move them into some totally different domain. And the question is, is moving one of those practices enough for that domain to have a totally different model of how they do things, or do they need all five, right? And I think in most cases they actually are just sort of putting their toe in the evolutionary gene pool, as it were, right? Like, trying to figure out whether or not these things will do that, will actually lead to massive change, or if they'll just be sort of temporary, failed experiments. And there are a tremendous number of failed experiments out there based on the success of free and open source software, right? And I think that's partially because it's this bit and piece mentality of taking bits, not everything can be free software either. That the fact that connections doesn't necessarily work at the level of collaborating between academics has nothing to do with whether or not all of those practices are taken over wholesale. It also has to do with very long entrenched systems of producing academic work in academia, right, and how that's done. And that's much slower to change, and you have to really think carefully if you want to change it about how to do that. And for some people it might be revolutionary, for other people it's very incremental, right? Usually large, powerful institutions tend to do things incrementally. So pretty safe to say that.
the evolutionary metaphor.
Are these five things necessarily sequential? Can they arise in any order? Do they have to arise simultaneously?
No, they weren't. They're not sequential. I mean, the way that I think about it is that they're defined around the point 1998, right? So they are. If you look at 1998, all of these things are there in their purest form around in the debates that were happening right at that moment around free and open source software. What it is, what it's for, what counts as open source or free software. What make up the practices of free software, which licenses you use, how you sell it to businesses, et cetera. Just an explosion of discourse right at that moment. And then if you start to look both into the past and into the present, you see the modulation of those practices, right? So if you look back at 1970, you had sharing source code, but you didn't have anything like this sense of a copyleft license at that point, at least not in the domain of software and information technology. you didn't have necessarily a sense of how you would coordinate collaboration outside of a firm, because you just didn't do that, right? You started a firm in order to have collaboration, right? So as these things move closer to 1998, they become part of this package called free and open source software. So it's an alternative to thinking about things historically as, you know, each of these genealogies having their own coherence, right? I start in 1998 and try and explode it in both directions.
Would you talk about the open source nanotechnology project?
Sure.
Briefly?
This is another failure. But
I'm becoming much more confident about failures as my career goes on. It was actually really interesting because there's a group there called the Center for Biological and Environmental Nanotechnology, and Vicky Colvin, who's the head of that, was talking to me one day about a separate project, and she said, "Oh, you know, I've been talking about open source nanotechnology all over the place," and I said, "You know, I've written a book about that." And she was very surprised, and we got to talking, and she explained what she was doing, which is that she had set one of her graduate students to working on a project to create magnetite nanocrystals, which are nanocrystals that you can put into water, and they bind to things like arsenic. They bind particularly well to arsenic. And then because they're made of iron, you can get them out with a magnet. So, but historically, people had a lot of trouble doing this without it, like, you know, 25 Tesla magnet or something, right? Like, you needed an enormous magnet to get these things out of solution. But they figured out a way to make them as nanocrystals, so they were colloidally monodisperse, and they came out of solution with a handheld magnet, right? And this was a big, they got this paper into Science and everything. They were very excited about it, but she's got this idea that she wants to spread this technology around the world, and one of the reasons is because pretty much the place where arsenic poisoning matters is Bangladesh, where there are, you know, something like 30,000 poisoned wells and just a tremendous amount of arsenic poisoning, right? So what she did was say to this graduate student, why don't you see if you can redo this in a way that isn't as expensive to make? Because the process that they had used in the laboratory was still pretty expensive. So he redid the entire process of making magnetite nanocrystals with olive oil, rust, and lye. And a saucepan and an open fire, and he figured out a way to do this, you know, basically in a kitchen or a restaurant or something like that. And I said, you know, using these five practices, I said, well, here's the things that you would want to do to try and make this available as a kind of science. And my pitch to her was, what you want to do is invite lots of people to participate at the level of innovation. Right, what you're saying to the world is not, here's this technology, it works really well to get arsenic out of water, but here's a process we've invented. We need to make it better, and we need to make it work in lots of diverse locales. Right, like say you don't have lye in your village. Right, what can you use instead? Say you use coconut oil or palm oil instead of olive oil. How does that change the reaction, et cetera, et cetera? And that we would then use the sort of collaboration and coordination of free and open source software to try and collect people's responses and whatnot. So the only reason that this has failed, I shouldn't say that it's a failure because it hasn't really been tried. The reason it's a failure is because their plan, and this is about the intersection with academia, was to get it published first, right? Which is actually a good idea in the sense that you want to draw a lot of attention to it. I mean, there's a website up there, but nobody's even found it. No one's noticed it yet, right? So it's like you just put a website up, nobody notices, right? But if you publish a paper or if you make a lot of effort to market it, then people will notice it, right? So the idea was, let's publish the paper. And it went to Nature, it went to Nature Nanotechnology, it went to Science, it went to JAX, it went to like five places and was rejected from all of them, essentially for the same reason, which was, this isn't novel. And the reason that chemists saw as not novel was because they had already published this Science paper which said how to make this in the laboratory, right? And so we really aren't, you know, in some ways we really weren't pushing that what makes it novel is that it's about the open source angle, not about the chemistry angle, right? And so we'll see. I mean, we'll probably figure out a way to put it somewhere else. There's a social science version that's being published. So we just can't get the chemistry version published yet.
Say something about public and in-person genome, mm-hmm. and where this fits this yeah. trend now that's relatively recent.
Church.
Exactly.
One of your principles, I see, has made his genome public. Not principles, but Keith Batchelder is one of them. Yeah. Brilliant. So people know about George Church's project, the personal genome. Is that what it's called, the personal genome? Yeah, to actually make the genomic information available, in part to make that data available for people to do research on, right? And to because so much of the genomic data that's generated, and there is so much of it, is proprietary in a variety of ways. And that can range from proprietary in a non-legal sense, in the sense that it's just hard to get access to, right? Because it's inside a corporation or it's not made available in a usable way, to proprietary in a legal sense. It's the genes are patented, the technique might be patented, the particular data format might be copyrighted, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So I think there's actually a really interesting story to be told here about the history of bioinformatics in this respect and the intersections between bioinformatics and free and open source software, because there's a lot of enthusiasm for free and open source software tools for analyzing the genome data, but the data has not necessarily been made available. And I think it's really interesting to ask why not. I don't know the answer why not, but certainly at the level of what's shareable, there's a couple of problems with sharing gene data. One is that it's very hard to get it into a standardized form that's usable in your laboratory as opposed to someone else's laboratory. But that's exactly the kind of thing that Drew Endy and his people were trying to address, was that if you at least get it into the form where I can plug it into my DNA synthesizer and create it in my lab, then it's shareable enough, right? And I can take that code, put it into my synthesizer, and actually have something and hope that it functions basically the same way that it did in your laboratory, right? There's a big component of this which is about the standardization of practices in the biology laboratories and corporations, about how people deal with this data. You guys deal with all the time, just essentially a standardization problem, which I think is bigger than, in some ways, the anxiety about making genomic data available. Right? I don't know about the ethical components of this so much, right? The anxiety
that's
people
what I was
have.
Asking about.
Yeah.
The individual. The licensing of individual data, as opposed to the standardization issues.
Yeah, and I think there's some interesting questions about it, because what free software licenses allowed people to do was not just make things free, but control them in a particular way, control their copying, and control them by saying, whatever you do with this, especially in the GPL version, whatever you do with this, you have to make its derivatives available as well. And you might think about, in terms of genetic data, the problems that poses, like, you know, oh yes, you can use this for any kind of study you want, but I'm Jewish, so you can't use it in pigs, right? Or, you know, whatever your personal constraints might be, how many of those can you add on to the circulation of data before it becomes essentially useless data, right? So the trade-off is between its standardization and its publicity and the individual's control over what kinds of uses it will have, right? And so if you can make the comparison with the Creative Commons licenses. They had 11 licenses at the first because they were trying to appeal to particular kinds of things that they thought people would have, reservations people would have about their stuff. You can't make it, you can't use it commercially, you can't make derivative works with it, you can distribute it to the third world but not to the first world, right? You can use it for educational purposes. At the beginning they had a whole bunch of these, and they mapped on to anxieties they expected people to have. And they were right about some of those and wrong about some of them. And it's really hard to guess what those are. It's really hard to foresee them.
I was wondering, why did open source music not catch on? Why does that not work the way software does?
You mean in terms of it being having all of the five practices really
right.
Fully? Well, I think it has, but it's definitely much, much smaller. It's not nearly as widespread as free software is. There's actually a pretty good body of freely licensed music and samples and stuff at this point. And the same is true of photos, right? If you use Flickr, you can get freely licensed photos pretty easily. You know, it's I don't know what percentage of the repository it is, but it's fairly large at this point. And that was one of the original goals of Creative Commons, was to begin to produce that archive, right, of things that could be freely reused, right? Mm-hmm. So I'm not sure it's fair to say that music hasn't taken off like that. It's still in the process of becoming more and more free, right? We're just entering the era where now you can finally get your music without DRM on it, as opposed, you know, much less be allowed to sample and reuse it in ways that are not controlled by the recording industry. So I would say it's a little too early to say that it hasn't taken off, but certainly it's in the domain of the underground, as it were, right? The people who are really committed to open source music. Any other questions? We've been at it for a while. The book is. Oh, I was supposed to say something about the cover too. For those of you who've been to the Boston Public Library, the panel here is from a 19th century symbolist painter named Pierre Puvis de Chavannes. He did a bunch of them around the entranceway to the Boston Public Library, which represent 19th century arts and industry. This is the telegraph. You can see just barely, if you look at the book, it's a lot clearer. They've got their hands on the wires, and it's colloquially known as good news, bad news. I was amazed in some ways that Duke just said, yeah, that's a great idea. We'll use that for the cover, because most people don't get to choose their covers. It's generated a lot of attention. People are very curious about the cover. The book is available online. It's licensed under a Creative Commons by NCSA license, which is the only one I could convince Duke to use. I convinced them to use it, which is great. The whole thing is available. It's also in a WordPress template that the Institute for the Future of the Book created called Comment Press, which allows you to comment on paragraph by paragraph. It's available for download, for remixing, for whatever. It's also available for sale. last time I checked at Amazon, it keeps going down. It's like $16. So the official price is like $23, but right now it's something like $16. It's out. It's available now. According to Amazon, it's not yet available, but you can still order it and get a copy. So. All right. Thank you very much.